At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's been bitter and it's been long. The so-called math wars have been fought for 20 years in school boards, teachers' colleges, and math departments of our nation's colleges. On one side, the reform math folks. On the other, the traditionalists. At stake, they say, America's future. Now the government has ordered a truce and drafted a new plan for America's classrooms. This hour, On Point, the government's new plan and the American way of learning math. Later in this hour, we'll sit down with a math teacher and two university mathematicians to see what exactly schools are teaching and why teaching math is so tough in the first place. But we kick off this hour first by getting an update on the new government plan that claims to have forged a truce in the math wars. Joining us from Boston is John Hechinger. He is the education reporter for The Wall Street Journal. John, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Tell us why this panel in the first place.
Well, here's sort of the elementary school explanation. Everybody seems to agree that American students don't much like math and, as a whole, aren't that good at it. And the deterioration of these skills could mean the end of the dominance of the United States in world affairs. So this math panel took 2 years, studied the research, and tried to figure out a way to fix this problem. And they came up with some pretty strong prescriptions. They said that students must learn the basics, like the multiplication tables in early grades. They have to be able to understand and be able to manipulate fractions and decimals in middle school. And they have to be able to take a rigorous algebra course by high school. Without this, the panel says that we're going to fall behind. It may sound simple, but teaching math in this country is incredibly bitter.
Well, so tell me a little bit about that. How are these prescriptions different from what the kids are doing now?
Well, if you look at most of the math curricula in the United States, kids are taught a wide variety of subjects. It's all over the map, and there's not a lot of agreement of what kids should learn and when they should learn it. So the difference here is you'd have a very focused curriculum that would be much like countries that are outperforming U.S. students. And students would be expected to master these subjects much, much earlier.
So tell us more about these math wars, this decade-long debate about exactly how to do this, how to teach math in the classroom. Specifically, there are two camps, as I understand it, the traditionalists and the reform math camp, the so-called fuzzy math camp. Who are these camps, and how are they different?
Well, it's good to take a little history here. I think all of this really started in the 1950s with the Soviet launch of the Sputnik satellite and a concern that we lost our technological edge. And you had a number of efforts to try to remedy this in math. One was the sort of new math of the 1960s, which was sort of widely lampooned. Tom Lehrer, the singer, said it's so simple, so very simple that only a child can do it.
Right.
And that was a sort of a decision to de-emphasize arithmetic and to focus on very abstract concepts. Then in 1989, you had a group of the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics that was worried that kids were losing interest and not doing well at math because there was what they called a drill-and-kill approach, making sure kids knew multiplication and drilling it over and over again and turning kids off. And what they decided, and what has now become known as reform math, is that it's better to stress concepts over computation. You give kids calculators in kindergarten. You ask kids to write about math rather than necessarily do it. And that they should discover these concepts, like, say, long division on their own, rather than learning them the standard way.
Well, why all the concern? Give us the numbers, John, would you? Are American children falling behind internationally? What do the numbers show?
Well, if you look at the the national test called NAEP, the Nation's Report Card, we've actually made some progress in recent years in math, particularly fourth and eighth grade. But as kids get older, they don't do nearly as well, and many, many children have to take remedial math in college. If you look at the international comparison, it is much worse. There was a test called PISA that is very influential that was released late last year, and U.S. students scored, I think it was 25th out of 30 developed countries, behind places like Finland and South Korea and the Netherlands. And that is very, very concerning because, after all, those are our economic competitors. Mm.
There was some concern, John, as I was reading about this, that the advisory board used only a handful of studies to base their findings on and then to create this report. So I'm wondering if there's some disappointment and some concern about the overall quality of the existing research on exactly how math is taught and exactly what our kids are learning.
I think everyone on the panel would agree on that. They studied, I think, thousands of different research efforts, and the problem is there isn't a lot of rigorous research, so that when math instruction turned away from kind of the basic sort of old-fashioned way of teaching math and started doing what people kind of call fuzzy math, there wasn't a lot of basis for that. But what the panel also said is there's not a lot of basis for the more rote approach either. So they kind of split the difference and said that both have strengths. You can't really expect kids to enjoy and go on in math if they don't understand the concepts. So there needs to be a balance between the two, and there also needs to be, you know, rigorous controlled research showing which is the better way.
So how does this panel report now translate into policy in the classroom? What's next, John?
Well, you know, in the United States, education is a local matter, and so we don't have a national curriculum, and that in many ways makes this quite difficult. Other countries like Singapore, which tend to do very well, they would take a program like this, and they would make it essentially a national law and make sure that every school studies this. And that's not going to happen in the United States, although it's been discussed. But what will happen is that school boards and parents, state education departments are going to study this, and they're going to look at the standards that they're using. And if the best minds have come up with these standards and their kids aren't learning, I think there's a very good chance that this will become a kind of a, if not an official national curriculum, something close to it.
John Hechinger joining us from Boston this morning, education reporter for the Wall Street Journal. John, thanks so much for your information and your time.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Appreciate
really
it. Joining me now in the studio is Mary Ike. She is the K-8 math coordinator for the Newton, Massachusetts public school system. She herself is the former 7th and 8th grade math teacher. Welcome to you, Mary. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So just on a very basic level, tell us what you do first.
I'm the math coordinator for the 15 elementary schools and the 4 middle schools in the Newton Public Schools.
In a suburban school district outside
mm-hmm.
Boston
mm-hmm.
that's
not
quite varied.
Yes. There's 11,000 children in the whole system, and about 80% are white. About 20% are eligible for free and reduced lunch. So, and the 20%, there's a mix of Asian, African American, Hispanic immigrants from all over the world.
So you've got a real melting pot,
we do.
A lot of different standards. And you wrote a report for your school district superintendent about this panel study
mm-hmm.
for math. What did you say? What was your conclusion?
Well, my conclusion was both global and specific to Newton. One is I agree with your earlier guest who said that it really is in some level a call for a national curriculum, which I think would be very helpful for my position as a math coordinator. I find it very difficult to match the specific learning goals at each grade with what may or may not turn out to be on our state test, the MCAS. So I fully support that. And I think that like your previous caller said, that many of the states will move towards that fairly quickly.
How are children these days, Mary, learning math differently than you and I learned it years ago?
Mm-hmm.
In a very basic level, what's the difference?
I think what the difference is that we, in the process of teaching mathematics, teaching the computational procedures, want children to understand the underlying structure of the number system. So when we're thinking about talking to children about learning their math facts, for example, we want them to understand not only that if that 6 plus 4 is 10, we also want them to understand that a way to think about subtraction is if the problem is 10 minus 4, we can think about that problem as what do you add to 4 to get 10, so that they can use their addition fact that they know to help them understand the subtraction fact. Seems very simple to us as adults, but it's actually quite a basic inverse operation that they can carry forward through the rest of their mathematics.
Why have these math wars been so divisive over all these years? Why is there such discontent?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. One is that I think many adults are uncomfortable about math, and when their children bring home something that they can't understand, especially if their children is in elementary school, they get aggravated at best. They can't do their third grader's homework, for example. That's got to be very frustrating. One of the improvements that we've tried to make in Newton is to really send home very explicit notes to parents about what it is that their children are learning and what we expect them to be doing, and not just sort of sending home some paper that can't be understood. But that said, another issue that we have in Newton, and I expect all over the country, is that parents really want their children to do well. It's really part of what they aspire to. And they understand that mathematics is a real key to success in our world now. And they're worried when they see something that they don't understand
and can't do themselves.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, that their child isn't getting a proper education.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the new National Math Teaching Plan for American schools. And we're asking whether children in India, China, and Singapore really know much more math and more of the right kind of math than our children do. In a little while, we'll do a little math homework ourselves to see what exactly the argument has been about. So grab a pencil and paper, and we'll see if you can keep up. First, let's get back to our guests. First, Mary Eich is in the studio with me. She is math coordinator for the public school system in Newton, Massachusetts. Also joining us is Professor Wilfried Schmidt, a member of the National Mathematics Advisory Panel that released its report last week. And also joining us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, is Joseph Rosenstein. He's a professor of mathematics at Rutgers University. His focus is on teaching teachers math and how to teach math to kids. And since the early 1990s, he's been the director of the New Jersey Mathematics and Science Education Coalition. Professor, it's good to have you.
Nice to be with you.
Glad to be here.
So let me turn to you, Professor Smith. Tell us how you became involved and active in this math debate.
Well, like many mathematicians, I got involved in mathematics education because of a very unfortunate experience my daughter had when she was in elementary school.
And what was that?
She is 16 now. In 1999, in second grade, she went to school in the Lincoln Public School System. And they are using a particular curriculum that does not have a textbook, so when she came home, we really had no indication of what was happening. One day, she came home very upset, and we asked her, well, what's the problem? She said, the teacher gave us some numbers to add, and now I should interject, this was three two-digit numbers, and I did it the way I know how. And here again, I should interject, this was long addition, which she'd learned in first grade. Mm-hmm. Then the teacher, when the teacher saw that, the teacher said, no, you're not allowed to add that way in school. You may add that way at home if you want to, but not in school. In school, you use numbers, you use your fingers or blocks.
So they were telling her to use a different method.
Well, I mean, they were telling her that she could not use the method that she had learned in school, a method that children should learn, and instead count on her fingers.
And so,
I first thought that this was just some mistaken teacher. But then, after a little while, I realized that the program that the school was using told the teachers quite explicitly that long addition should not be taught. And in addition, when children learn long addition elsewhere, they should be discouraged from using it.
So you made your way for a long progression to the National Mathematics Advisory Panel that released this final report this month.
I did.
Tell me, if you would, how hard it was to come to a consensus with your own experience in this, with recommendations moving forward for teaching our kids math.
I don't think it was difficult at all. I think that the panel was asked to use the best available evidence, best available research. And I must say that there was a wide range of, on the one hand, mathematics educators who were presumed to be sympathetic to reform math. On the other hand, there were mathematicians like me, and then a substantial number of cognitive psychologists. And we did not have a hard time agreeing on the outline of this report.
Professor Rosenstein, to your mind, does this report amount to a reversal in the math guidelines that we've been following for years?
The report is actually very complicated. I want to emphasize one of the things that Mary said when she spoke to you. She said that what the change has been is over the time when most of us were in school is we want children to learn the underlying structure of the system, that not just simply learning the multiplication facts, but learning the structure of the system. And that's a very good characterization of what the reform movement is about. The idea that it should be called fuzzy math is like a very pejorative term, and it really shouldn't be used. That's a term invented by the critics. There's nothing fuzzy about the reform effort in mathematics. And what's happened is in this report, there's very clearly the statement that simply learning the multiplication table is not enough, that you do have to have the understanding of what it's all about. You have to understand, as Mary said, the underlying structure of the system. So I wouldn't characterize this report as simply a victory for the back-to-basics movement, as it seems to have been said here. It is saying that you need to have both the facility with the mathematical operations, but you also need to have the understanding. You need to have the problem-solving approach, which was really emphasized in the document that John Hechinger mentioned before by the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics in 1989, which focused on problem solving, which focused on learning for understanding, which focused on reasoning. All of those have found their way into this report. So I think this report, in a way, in addition to, you know, as it says, as some people say, emphasizing some of the basics, also emphasizes the importance of the themes that the reform movement introduced 15, 20 years ago.
Professor Smith?
Well, I certainly agree with that. But what I have to say is that critics of reform mathematics like me have never said that we should just concentrate on computation. We have always said that there has to be a balance between computational facility and understanding of what's actually being done. So that is the first remark. Secondly, the problem that critics like me saw following, let's say, the 1989 NCTM guidelines is that they seem to imply and were often taken to imply that there was somehow a choice to be made between properly teaching a computational facility on the one hand and conceptual understanding. And we always maintained you have to do both.
Let's bring this back to the classroom, if you will, because Mary, Ike, you are there. You see the kids. You deal with the teachers. We hear lots of big ideas and things. But how does this apply now to our kids who are learning?
Well, we could take a really first-hand example about thinking about how to teach two-digit by two-digit multiplication. And the question there is that we really want to have two things going on at the same time. We wanted to have kids be able to do a computation efficiently and achieve a correct answer. We want them to do that regularly. We don't want that to be a laborious task or something that's just something that they feel as though they have anxiety over, they can't possibly do it. On the other hand, there are many, many opportunities for exploring the structure of the number system there. So in the instructional process, we really want to illuminate the relationship, say, between the tens and the ones. So having children understand that if you multiply tens by tens, you're going to be getting hundreds. So it's that sort of thing that we've tried to incorporate into our instruction that I think might not have been done 20 years ago.
Is it fair to say, panel, that learning math and doing math are two very different things? And there's an element here of adults or parents getting impatient. They see all the gymnastics that some of this reform math calls for. They see this on paper. They don't understand it themselves. It seems like a bit of a waste of time. What does it mean for the kids? Professor Rosenstein?
Thank you. So, again, it's a question of balance. And as Professor Schmidt said, and I think after its initial report, the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics backtracked a bit and said, yes, the balance is very important. So that, in that sense, we all agree that there should be a balance here. And there is, as you say, a difference between learning math, in a sense, and doing math. If you think of learning math as learning the math facts, that's important, but it's also important to understand where those facts come from, and some exploration of where they come from and what all of these terms mean is also very important. And yes, the consequence is that sometimes you spend a lot more time, in effect, playing with numbers, but the understanding that you achieve at the end, if properly guided, can be very, very valuable. So yes, it may take more time to learn the multiplication table than the easy way of doing it, of course, the easy way of ensuring that kids learn the multiplication table by the desired time is to simply offer them $5 to learn the multiplication table.
To just learn it, to memorize it.
That's right, just memorize it. And there's a value to that, of course. It's important to be able to say, that everyone be able to say that 7 times 8 is 56 without having to, you know, start from scratch every time you do it. But it's also important to understand where those facts come from. And that comes about through guided explorations, and that's been a really very important feature of, as Mary says, the last 20 years since the focus has become on learning for understanding.
Let's go to the phones and invite a caller into our conversation. Jakob is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Sure.
My name is Jakob. I used to teach mathematics at the high school and middle school level, and right now I help run a tutoring organization where I do some mathematics tutoring myself with some students. And the point I want to make is twofold, and I'd like to hear your guest comments on it as well. The first thing is, one thing I've learned to do in working with students is to introduce certain aspects of working with mathematics earlier in the education process, such as the use of variables. Introducing that as early as second and third grade, not like most schools do in sixth and seventh, because as soon as a student knows how to add two numbers together, say 2 plus 4 is 6, you could turn that problem into 2 plus 4 is X, what is X? And introducing such abstract concepts earlier in life to students so that they become very comfortable with them, I found that gives them great more flexibility with working with new problems. The second point is I was reading a very interesting article on reform versus traditional mathematics education, and the author drew a very interesting comparison between how we teach math now and how, say, we might be teaching art. When we just focus on root memorization and formulas, it's very close to, if in art education, if we were to teach the kids all the theories of how colors mix and what colors produce, but we never actually let them paint anything. Mm-hmm. And we really need to guide kids through the exploration of these concepts on their own, instead of just feeding them these formulas and expecting them to memorize them.
Thank you so much, Jakob. Professor Smid, your comments.
Well, I think the issue of, let's say, introducing variables early, when it's done properly, then by all means. But one should always make sure that the kids are engaged, that it makes sense to them. So I really don't see any problem as long as kids know what they're doing and are comfortable.
Mary?
Yeah, I think that somewhat goes back to the point I was making before about understanding the inverse relationship between addition and subtracting when learning math facts, that a way to think about subtraction is to say, what do we add to 6 to get 10? I mean, it's not much of a hop from there to saying 6 plus X equals 10, what is X? So I think that's perfectly accessible to young children that are, you know, as they're going through learning age-appropriate mathematics. I think the other question about thinking about fact memorization is also exploring, say, for example, in the question 7 times 8, what is the relationship between 7 times 8 and 14 times 4? Or what's the relationship between 7 times 8 and 7 times 80 or 70 times 80? So that we take these facts and that we push them out a little bit further into larger numbers or different numbers, and we explore their relationships there. And that,
so it's not just a memorization. It's thinking outside the box of the equation, if you will.
Right.
Well, if the memorization is there and is understood that it has to be there, then I agree. So what the math panel says, and the contribution of the cognitive psychologists, is that there is really an understanding in psychology that to be able to think and to do, you want to put as much as possible from short-term memory into long-term memory.
Professor Rosenstein?
Yes, I was going to use the comment by the caller to go in a different direction, and that is that, yes, it certainly is possible for kids to understand notion of variables and how to use them early, but they can only do that if their teachers are able to introduce those notions well. And one of the major flaws of this document, as from my perspective, is that it pays very, very little attention to the professional development of teachers. It does talk about training of new teachers. But, you know, we have, that only improves things 1 year at a time. We have a substantial cohort of teachers who are teaching in the schools now who will find it very difficult to implement many of the things that are in this report. And the report should have called for a massive effort at professional development of teachers. That has not taken place over a long period of time, and many teachers need assistance to do these kinds of things. I think that's a very, very important thing. For example, also, one of the recommendations that the panel makes is that more students should take algebra in the eighth grade. Now, the problem is that many of the teachers at the eighth grade level don't have a mathematics background. They only have rudimentary mathematics courses that they took before, and so many of the students who will be pushed to take algebra earlier will be taking courses from teachers who are really not qualified to teach algebra.
So they're struggling
with
it themselves.
And moreover, the assistance that they need will not be provided. It's not done in any systematic way. In some districts, it's done well. In some states, it's done better than others. But is it really a patchwork? And what that requires is a substantial amount of funds. And there's no recommendation here for that.
And I need to go to the phones. Back to Sally, who's in Boston, Massachusetts. Sally, welcome to the show.
Hi, welcome. I mean, thank you. Hello, Jane.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for you and your panel was whether there was a rationale for teaching things in this country to children later than they're taught to children in other countries. I was thinking specifically of the times tables.
Ah, good question. Sally, Professor Schmidt?
Well, I think that what we did in the National Math Panel is to look at, let's say, when various skills were acquired in other countries. And I think there is a fair amount of consensus that, for example, addition facts should be completely understood by second grade, multiplication facts by fourth grade. There is something like an international consensus, and the United States should go along with that.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Now that the math wars are supposedly over, we're looking at how kids should be taught math in schools in the coming years. A reminder, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org, and see some samples of what your kids are being taught and for other links there. My guests are Mary Eich, math coordinator for the Newton, Massachusetts Public School System, Wilfried Schmidt, professor of mathematics at Harvard University, and Joseph Rosenstein, professor of mathematics at Rutgers University. Wilfried, you wanted to respond to one of the callers who was talking about teacher development as it relates to the National Mathematics Advisory Panel recommendations.
Well, actually, that was Joseph Rosenstein's comment.
Go ahead.
He criticized the report for not really saying more about professional development. So professional development is the teaching of teachers who are already in the schools. And it is an enormous industry in the United States. An enormous amount of money goes into this. And the problem that we see is that there are all kinds of models. There has not been any convincing evidence that any particular model is successful. And we are quite sure that a lot of money is being misspent. I think if the money that goes into professional development were well spent, it would be quite sufficient. So what we need is a much better understanding of what works in professional development.
Professor Rosenstein?
Well, it certainly would help to know what works. There's no question about that. But there is not a lot of money being spent. I'm quite aware of that because I spend a lot of time dealing with that issue. There's not a lot of money being spent. It's one of the things that's first discarded once there's a tightness in the budget. And there certainly is no concerted effort to do it well. And that's a problem. Now, there may be money that's wasted, as Professor Schmidt says, because not all professional development is good professional development, and I don't disagree with that. But there certainly has never been an effort to figure out what works and how to institutionalize it. That certainly hasn't happened. I'd like to make a comment in response to the previous caller.
Okay, quickly, go ahead.
She made a note. She asked the question whether it should be taken for granted that because other countries have certain topics taught at a certain age level, that we should do the same here. And I'd like to just point out that, you know, when I was in high school many, many years ago, when kids came from other countries, they were often a year or two ahead of us, and that was not a problem. So it's not automatically the case that we have to follow what the other countries do. The research shows that the kids can do it at that time, but the research does not show that it's good to do it as early as possible. And since this was intended to be a report which was research-based, I find that making the recommendations that everything should be done in this what appears to be a lockstep fashion at as early as possible grade levels is not research-based and may not be the best for our kids and may not be what our teachers can accomplish,
without
professional development.
No. Right. I mean, I think that the psychologists certainly are completely on board that these are totally realistic goals. And they are also dictated by getting into algebra in ninth grade. I mean, if you want to have kids succeed in algebra in ninth grade, they have to have certain prerequisites, and if you back map them, then you get to this result.
Let's bring this back to the kitchen table for a minute. Mary Ike, I want to bring you back in. So much frustration when the homework is actually being done by moms and dads who learned these concepts in different ways so many years before. What do you tell them? Give us some news you can use at this point with this panel recommendation.
Well, often at this point, I think when the homework comes home, there'll be some note from the teacher, or the teacher may have sent home, particularly in elementary schools, they typically send home a letter at the beginning of the week or the month saying what the topics are going to be studied. I would look at that first to see if the teacher gave any kind of hints to parents about how to manage this homework this week or this month. Another source would be the internet. There's all kinds of definitions now of if you've forgotten what a rhombus is, you can look that up very quickly on the internet now. Some of the math programs have a home reference book that give step-by-step procedures for some of these things. So the references are out there. They just don't necessarily come home in a textbook. In some cases, they do. But another approach is really to ask your child what they already know about the question, because kids get themselves to a point where they get very frustrated because they don't know what to do next, but they actually do know quite a bit about the problem. So one approach is just to try to step back and say, well, tell me what you do know. I understand there's things you don't know, but what do you know?
Can you take us through a problem?
Sure.
Mary, walk us through a math problem. Here mm-hmm. we are. Doing homework. We actually have yellow pads and number two pencils here in the studio. So help us, show us the different forms, the different methods of teaching.
Okay,
talk us through it.
We chose a multiplication problem, a two-digit by two-digit multiplication problem, 26 times 31. So if we were going to do that in the traditional way, we would write the 26 over the 31, and we would be careful to align the tens with the tens, so put the 2 over the 3 and the 6 and the 1s with the 1, so that means putting the 6 over 1.
One number over the other.
Right. Yeah. And our next step would be to take the 1 from the 31 and multiply that by the 6 from the 26, and we would write down the result of that 6 underneath. Then we would take that 1 and we would multiply it by the 2 of the 36, and 1 times 2 is 2. So Now we've determined that the result of multiplying 26 times 1 is 26.
Okay. Listeners, are you keeping up with this? I'm barely, and I'm looking at the numbers. But anyway, so it keeps going like this.
And then our next step is we look at the 3 from the 31. And we say, okay, what's 3 times 6? And we find that that's 18. But we can't really write the whole 18 there. because we can only have room for one digit. So we have to carry that one. And then we go 3 times 2 is 6, add the 1 is 7, 78. We add those up. We've been careful to put them in the right column. We get 806. That's the traditional way that I think many adults would be comfortable with.
Right.
What we're trying to do in the instructional part of probably 3rd and 4th and 5th grade now is to ask children to look at that problem somewhat differently. You might have noticed that when I talked about the 3 in 31, I talked about it as a 3. We'd like for children to really think about that as 30.
So the relational balance between the numbers.
The 3 in the tens place has a different meaning than the 3 would mean if it were in the ones place. So we'd like the children really to be looking at that problem 26 times 31 and thinking first that their first job is to multiply 30 times 20. And if they know their extended multiplication facts, they'll know right away that that's 600. So 30 times 20 is 600.
Then is this faster? How is this different? How is it better? How is it worse? How is this form than what you're doing now? The relational change between those numbers, how is it different?
For two-digit by two-digit multiplication, I would say it's not much slower. If kids were very good at it and not good at the other, it would be faster. But once you get into more digits than that, it's probably not very efficient. But the value of it is it really explains why the result is in the hundreds. It really explains that instead of 3 times 2, you're really talking about 30 times 20. And if we expand it as far as this whole topic, as far as it can go, it really is looking at the distributive property. We can carry that forward to multiplication of binomials.
Binomials, yes.
Well, can I ask you...
Jump in, Professor.
Can I ask you you think that children eventually should be able to proficiently use the algorithm for multiplication?
And an algorithm is?
This is the standard method for multiplying two numbers with any number of digits. I mean, the traditional way of writing down a multiplication. If you see what you say, I have absolutely no objection to. If, in the end, the bottom line is that the kids learn the algorithm and can carry it out.
Mary?
The algorithm that I'm proposing, what we call the partial products, I think works equally efficiently for two-digit multiplication as does what we think of as a traditional algorithm. Beyond that, like I said, if we're looking at three-digit by two-digit or anything larger than that, it's inefficient because you have so many partial products that you have to add them up. It takes too much time.
But should the children master the standard algorithm?
I think they probably should. It's much more efficient. However, I think at a lot of if we teach that directly without going through this step, a lot of the value of the place value, the place value relationships, and what we're doing when we're breaking apart and putting back together numbers would be obscured if not lost.
Well,
Professor Rosenstein, let me bring
should.
You back in here. Is all this in the eyes of the beholder, as far as listening to and going through a math problem?
I think what both are saying is quite correct. I mean, in other words, if you start with the standard algorithm, which is the way that all of us who are older than 35 saw it, then we really don't understand, by and large, what it means. If you were to play another one of Tom Lehrer's songs, he has that exactly in it. You said, carry the 1, carry the 9. I mean, it doesn't make sense. All it is something that's memorized. So it's really very important, as Mary says, to go through for example, the method that she used, so that the student can understand what you're doing. And once you understand what you're doing, ultimately you come to the point where you can do it with great facility, and then you can use the standard algorithm because it's become, you know, routine. You understand it. So both are certainly correct, and in fact, that's the way it's quite reasonable to teach it that way.
Yeah, but Mary,
but not every student will be able to achieve that facility in the same time frame, which is one of the problems with the recommendations, that they're assuming that all kids can do this in the time frame that they want. Some kids will take longer to do it.
So child by child, it's all.
I
have to go to the phones, and I want to get Alexander in now from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for the show.
Sure.
I have an experience of being a child growing up in the 70s, and at that time, there was a educational fad, as I'd like to call it, that came through that went by the moniker of Chisholm Bop.
Chisholm Bop.
What this was it was utilizing the hands and fingers as a primitive abacus. And we were told that this was going to rescue American children from their mathematical woes at that time. And we were given as evidence, small Asian children who were, cracking huge problems on nothing more than their fingers.
Did it rescue you, Alexander?
Oh, it was interesting, and it gave you a certain, appreciation for places. But it really didn't have any lasting power. And within, a span of years, it disappeared. And I'd like your panel to comment, if they may, about whatever happened to Chisholm Bop.
Wilfred Schmidt, what do you think? Do you remember
I never
it?
Heard of it.
Okay, Mary, I
never heard of it. But what I should say is that, of course, there are many fads, and we should go away from fads.
I actually have heard of it, but I don't know much about it, so I can't speak to it.
Professor Rosenstein?
I don't have anything to add. I mean, as Professor Schmidt says, there are many fads which come up, and they may have some value, but they often don't have lasting value. But the point is that it may very well happen that if a teacher knows some other strategy for doing it, that might work out well, but it might not.
Jane is on the line now from Boston, Massachusetts. Jane, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to this and think I'm an international student from China.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to share a little bit experience how we learn mathematics that year. And I heard that kids here are frustrated that their parents cannot help them. And I remember when my sister and I were in elementary school in China, my parents didn't help us at all at home. And I personally feel it's not their duty to do that. It's the teacher's duty at the school. And also, when kids have problems in China, I think we have study groups. We have students who understand what a teacher taught at a class to explain to students who didn't get it how to do it. In that way, I think it's easier for the students to get it. And also, another point that we talk about how teacher feels to what degree the student can learn mathematics. And I feel like it's how students can are capable of getting those knowledge. It's not what adults think that the students should get.
Jane,
and
thanks.
I think the teacher's role is to help students develop what they're capable of.
Hmm. Jane, thanks so much for your call. Wilfred?
Well, I think, in fact, I agree that children, I mean, we should not have to rely too much on parents helping, and that the practice of having, let's say, groups where some children help others, that makes perfect sense.
Where does technology fall into all this? You've got a computer and high-end calculator. Do you need to learn as much as we did when we were young?
I think there's a few things that have dropped from the curriculum. The process of finding a square root by hand, we don't really teach that anymore. Because it can easily be done. We can teach children the way to approximate it to a decimal point or two, but it's not worth the computational time that it takes to do that. But for the most part, I don't think there's much need for children to use a calculator for computation other than as a exercise in, first of all, learning how to use it. But it does serve some interesting purposes. One of the things that we do in the early grades is we have a game we call Beat the Calculator. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the children are supposed to be able to recite their math facts more quickly than they could if they entered it on a calculator. And it's a good motivator. So there's a few ways that we can do it. And it also makes real-life problems based, and real-life in this sense, based on data that children collect, more accessible to some children. But I think our main task in elementary school in particular is to really have children become very adept and very fluent with number and number relationships.
I know there are passionate views on all sides here. I've only got a couple of minutes left, and I just want to give everyone the last word where you see this going moving forward. Professor Rosenstein?
Yes, I'd like to comment on the last speaker, not on what she said so much, but on the point that much of what we're talking about when we talk about the different educational systems in different countries is that the role of the culture is very important. In many of the countries that we're compared with, the students are very willing learners. In our country, that's not always the case. Teachers have to compete with many other factors, with all of the media, and it makes it much more difficult. And also in many countries, students have inculcated in them a respect for teachers, where they sort of stand up when the teacher walks into the classroom. If my class did that to me, I would be amazed that that such a thing should happen. I don't think it happens here at all. So that's an important factor to keep in mind, that many of the concerns that people have about the mathematics that our kids learn are not going to be solved simply by
Wilfred Schmidt, very quickly, last word.
Jump into that. I agree with that. But talking about calculators, there is no question that in many reform curricula, calculators were vastly overused and kept children from acquiring computational fluency.
Wilfred Schmidt, Mary Eich, Joseph Rosenstein. Thanks to all of you very much for a very spirited discussion. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.